The gentleman that bought him was a young Cornish gentleman, whose name was Trefry, a man of great wit and fine learning, and was carried into those parts by the Lord Governor to manage all his affairs. He, reflecting on the last words of Orinoco to the captain, and beholding the richness of his vest, no sooner came into the boat but he fixed his eyes on him, and finding something so extraordinary in his face, his shape and mien, a greatness of look and haughtiness in his air, and finding he spoke English, had a great mind to be inquiring into his quality and fortune, which, though Orinoco endeavoured to hide, by only confessing he was above the rank of common slaves, Trefry soon found he was yet something greater than he confessed, and from that moment began to conceive so vast an esteem for him, that he ever after loved him as his dearest brother, and showed him all the civilities due so great a man. Trefry was a very good mathematician and a linguist, could speak French and Spanish, and in the 3 days they remained in the boat, for so long were they going from the ship to the plantation, he entertained Orinoco so agreeably with his art and discourse that he was no less pleased with Trefry than he was with the prince, and he thought himself at least fortunate in this, that since he was a slave, as long as he would suffer himself to remain so, he had a man of so excellent wit and parts for a master. So that, before they had finished their voyage up the river, he made no scruple of declaring to Trefry all his fortunes, and most part of what I have here related, and put himself wholly into the hands of his new friend, whom he found resenting all the injuries were done him, and was charmed with all the greatnesses of his actions, which were recited with that modesty and delicate sense as wholly vanquished him, and subdued him to his interest. And he promised him on his word and honour he would find the means to reconduct him to his own country again, assuring him he had a perfect abhorrence of so dishonourable an action, and that he would sooner have died than have been the author of such a perfidy. He found the prince was very much concerned to know what became of his friends, and how they took their slavery, and Trefry promised to take care about the inquiring after their condition, and that he should have an account of them. Though, as Orinoco afterwards said, he had little reason to credit the words of a Bacchari, yet he knew not why, but he saw a kind of sincerity and awful truth in the face of Trefry, he saw an honesty in his eyes, and he found him wise and witty enough to understand honour. For it was one of his maxims, a man of wit could not be a knave or villain. In their passage up the river, they put in at several houses for refreshment, and ever when they landed, numbers of people would flock to behold this man. Not but their eyes were daily entertained with the sights of slaves, but the fame of Orinoco was gone before him, and all people were in admiration of his beauty. Besides, he had a rich habit on, in which he was taken, so different from the rest, and which the captain could not strip him of, because he was forced to surprise his person in the minute he sold him. When he found his habit made him liable, as he thought, to be gazed at the more, he begged Trefry to give him something more befitting a slave, which he did, and took off his robes. Nevertheless he shone through all, and his Ozenbrigs, a sort of brown Holland suit he had on, could not conceal the graces of his looks and mien, and he had no less admirers than when he had his dazzling habit on. The royal youth appeared in spite of the slave, and people could not help treating him after a different manner, without designing it. As soon as they approached him, they venerated and esteemed him. His eyes insensibly commanded respect, and his behaviour insinuated it into every soul, so that there was nothing talked of but this young and gallant slave, even by those who yet knew not that he was a prince. I ought to tell you that the Christians never buy any slaves, but they give 'em some name of their own, their native ones being very likely very barbarous and hard to pronounce, so that Mr. Trefry gave Orinoco that of Caesar, which name will live in that country as long as that, scarce more, glorious one of the great Roman, for 'tis most evident he wanted no part of the personal courage of that Caesar, and acted things as memorable, had they been done in some part of the world replenished with people and historians that might have given him his due. But his misfortune was to fall in an obscure world, that afforded only a female pen to celebrate his fame, though I doubt not but it had lived from others' endeavours if the Dutch, who immediately after his time took that country, had not killed, banished, and dispersed all those that were capable of giving the world this great man's life much better than I have done. And Mr. Trefry, who designed it, died before he began it, and bemoaned himself for not having undertook it in time. For the future, therefore, I must call Orinoco Caesar, since by that name only he was known in our western world, and by that name he was received on shore at Parham House, where he was destined a slave. But if the king himself, God bless him, had come ashore, there could not have been greater expectation by all the whole plantation, and those neighbouring ones, than was on ours at that time, and he was received more like a governor than a slave. Notwithstanding, as the custom was, they assigned him his portion of land, his house, and his business up in the plantation. But as it was more for form than any design to put him to his task, he endured no more of the slave but the name, and remained some days in the house, receiving all visits that were made him, without stirring towards that part of the plantation where the negroes were. At last he would needs go view his land, his house, and the business assigned him. But he no sooner came to the houses of the slaves, which are like a little town by itself, the negroes having all left work, but they all came forth to behold him, and found he was that prince who had at several times sold most of them to these parts, and from a veneration they pay to great men, especially if they know him, and from the surprise and awe they had at the sight of him, they all cast themselves at his feet, crying out in their language, "Live, O King! Long live, O King!" and kissing his feet, paid him even divine homage. Several English gentlemen were with him, and what Mr. Trefry had told him was here confirmed, of which he himself before had no other witness than Caesar himself, but he was infinitely glad to find his grandeur confirmed by the adoration of all the slaves. Caesar, troubled with their overjoy and over-ceremony, besought him to rise, and to receive him as their fellow-slave, assuring them he was no better, at which they set up with one accord a most terrible and hideous mourning and condoling, which he and the English had much ado to appease. But at last they prevailed with him, and they prepared all their barbarous music, and every one killed and dressed something of his own stock, for every family had their land apart, on which, at their leisure times, they breed all eatable things, and clubbing it together, made a most magnificent supper, inviting their grandee captain, their prince, to honour it with his presence, which he did, and several English with him, where they all waited on him, some playing, some dancing before him all the time, according to the manners of their several nations, and with unwearied industry endeavouring to please and delight him. While they sat at meat, Mr. Trefry told Caesar that most of these young slaves were undone in love with a fine she-slave, whom they had had about 6 months on their land. The prince, who never heard the name of love without a sigh, nor any mention of it without the curiosity of examining further into that tale, which of all discourses was most agreeable to him, asked how they came to be so unhappy as to be all undone for one fair slave. Trefry, who was naturally amorous and loved to talk of love as well as anybody, proceeded to tell him they had the most charming black that ever was beheld on their plantation, about 15 or 16 years old, as he guessed, that for his part he had done nothing but sigh for her ever since she came, and that while all the white beauties he had seen never charmed him so absolutely as this fine creature had done, and that no man of any nation ever beheld her that did not fall in love with her, and that she had all the slaves perpetually at her feet, and that the whole country resounded with the fame of Clemeny. "For so," said he, "we have christened her. But she denies us all with such a noble disdain that 'tis a miracle to see that she who can give such eternal desires should herself be all ice and unconcern. She is adorned with the most graceful modesty that ever beautified youth, the softest sire, that, if she were capable of love, one would swear she languished for some absent happy man, and so retired as if she feared a rape even from the god of day, or that the breezes would steal kisses from her delicate mouth. Her task of work some sighing lover every day makes it his petition to perform for her, which she accepts blushing, and with reluctancy, for fear he will ask her a look for a recompense, which he dares not presume to hope, so great an awe she strikes into the hearts of her admirers." "I do not wonder," replied the prince, "that Clemeny should refuse slaves, being, as you say, so beautiful, but wonder how she escapes those that can entertain her as you can do, or why, being your slave, you do not oblige her to yield." "I confess," said Trefry, "when I have, against her will, entertained her with love so long as to be transported with my passion even above decency, I have been ready to make use of those advantages of strength and force nature has given me. But, oh, she disarms me with that modesty and weeping, so tender and so moving, that I retire and thank my stars she overcame me." The company laughed at his civility to a slave, and Caesar only applauded the nobleness of his passion and nature, since that slave might be noble, or what was better, have true notions of honour and virtue in her. Thus passed they this night, after having received from the slaves all imaginable respect and obedience. The next day Trefry asked Caesar to walk when the heat was allayed, and designedly carried him by the cottage of the fair slave, and told him she whom he spoke of last night lived there retired. "But," says he, "I would not wish you to approach, for I am sure you will be in love as soon as you behold her." Caesar assured him he was proof against all the charms of that sex, and that if he imagined his heart could be so perfidious to love again after a moinder, he believed he should tear it from his bosom. They had no sooner spoke, but a little shock dog, that Clemeny had presented her, which she took great delight in, ran out, and she, not knowing anybody was there, ran to get it in again, and bolted out on those who were just speaking of her. When seeing them, she would have run in again, but Trefry caught her by the hand and cried, "Clemeny, however you fly a lover, you ought to pay some respect to this stranger," pointing to Caesar. But she, as if she had resolved never to raise her eyes to the face of a man again, bent him the more to the earth, when he spoke, and gave the prince the leisure to look the more at her. There needed no long gazing or consideration to examine who this fair creature was. He soon saw a moinder all over her. In a minute he saw her face, her shape, her air, her modesty, and all that called forth his soul with joy at his eyes, and left his body destitute of almost life. It stood without motion, and for a minute knew not that it had a being, and I believe he had never come to himself, so oppressed he was with overjoy, if he had not met with this allay, that he perceived a moinder fall dead in the hands of Trefry. This awakened him, and he ran to her aid, and caught her in his arms, where by degrees she came to herself, and 'tis needless to tell with what transports, what ecstasies of joy, they both a while beheld each other without speaking. They snatched each other to their arms, then gazed again, as if they still doubted whether they possessed the blessing they grasped. But when they recovered their speech, 'tis not to be imagined what tender things they expressed to each other, wondering what strange fate had brought them again together. They soon informed each other of their fortunes, and equally bewailed their fate, but at the same time they mutually protested that even fetters and slavery were soft and easy, and would be supported with joy and pleasure, while they could be so happy to possess each other, and be able to make good their vows. Caesar swore he disdained the empire of the world, while he could behold his moinder, and she despised grandeur and pomp, those vanities of her sex, when she could gaze on Orinoco. He adored the very cottage where she resided, and said that little inch of the world would give him more happiness than all the universe could do, and she vowed it was a palace while adorned with the presence of Orinoco. Trefry was infinitely pleased with this novel, and found this Clemeny was the fair mistress of whom Caesar had before spoke, and was not a little satisfied that heaven was so kind to the prince as to sweeten his misfortunes by so lucky an accident, and leaving the lovers to themselves, was impatient to come down to Parham House, which was on the same plantation, to give me an account of what had happened. I was as impatient to make these lovers a visit, having already made a friendship with Caesar, and from his own mouth learned what I have related, which was confirmed by his Frenchman, who was set on shore to seek his fortune, and of whom they could not make a slave, because a Christian, and he came daily to Parham Hill to see and pay his respects to his pupil prince. So that, concerning and interesting myself in all that related to Caesar, whom I had assured of liberty as soon as the governor arrived, I hasted presently to the place where these lovers were, and was infinitely glad to find this beautiful young slave, who had already gained all our esteems, for her modesty and her extraordinary prettiness, to be the same I had heard Caesar speak so much of. One may imagine, then, we paid her a treble respect, and though from her being carved in fine flowers and birds all over her body, we took her to be of quality before, yet when we knew Clemeny was a moinder, we could not enough admire her. I had forgot to tell you that those who are nobly born of that country are so delicately cut and raised all over the forepart of the trunk of their bodies, that it looks as if it were japanned, the works being raised like high point round the edges of the flowers. Some are only carved with a little flower or bird at the sides of the temples, as was Caesar, and those who are so carved over the body resemble our ancient Picts that are figured in the chronicles, but these carvings are more delicate. From that happy day Caesar took Clemony for his wife, to the general joy of all people, and there was as much magnificence as the country would afford at the celebration of this wedding, and in a very short time after she was conceived with child, which made Caesar even adore her, knowing he was the last of his great race. This new accident made him more impatient of liberty, and he was every day treating with Trefria for his and Clemony's liberty, and offered either gold or a vast quantity of slaves, which should be paid before they let him go, provided he could have any security that he should go when his ransom was paid. They fed him from day to day with promises, and delayed him till the Lord Governor should come, so that he began to suspect them of falsehood, and that they would delay him until the time of his wife's delivery, and make a slave of that too, for all the breed is theirs to whom the parents belong. This thought made him very uneasy, and his sullenness gave them some jealousies of him, so that I was obliged, by some persons who feared a mutiny, which is very fatal sometimes in those colonies that abound so with slaves, that they exceed the whites in vast numbers, to discourse with Caesar, and to give him all the satisfaction I possibly could. They knew he and Clemony were scarce an hour in a day from my lodgings, that they ate with me, and that I obliged him in all things I was capable of. I entertained them with the loves of the Romans, and great men, which charmed him to my company, and her with teaching her all the pretty works that I was mistress of, and telling her stories of nuns, and endeavouring to bring her to the knowledge of the true God. But of all discourses Caesar liked that the worst, and would never be reconciled to our notions of the Trinity, of which he ever made a jest. It was a riddle, he said, would turn his brain to conceive, and one could not make him understand what faith was. However, these conversations failed not altogether so well to divert him, that he liked the company of us women much above the men, for he could not drink, and he is but an ill companion in that country that cannot. So that, obliging him to love us very well, we had all the liberty of speech with him, especially myself, whom he called his great mistress, and indeed my word would go a great way with him. For these reasons I had opportunity to take notice to him that he was not well pleased of late, as he used to be. He was more retired and thoughtful, and told him I took it ill he should suspect we would break our words with him, and not permit both him and Clemony to return to his own kingdom, which was not so long away, but when he was once on his voyage he would quickly arrive there. He made me some answers that showed a doubt in him, which made me ask what advantage it would be to doubt. It would but give us a fear of him, and possibly compel us to treat him so, I should be very loath to behold. That is, it might occasion his confinement. Perhaps this was not so luckily spoke of me, for I perceived he resented that word, which I strove to soften again in vain. However, he assured me that, whatsoever resolutions he should take, he would act nothing upon the white people, and as for myself and those upon that plantation where he was, he would sooner forfeit his eternal liberty and life itself than lift his hand against his greatest enemy on that place. He besought me to suffer no fears upon his account, for he could do nothing that honour should not dictate, but he accused himself for having suffered slavery so long. Yet he charged that weakness on love alone, who was capable of making him neglect even glory itself, and for which now he reproaches himself every moment of the day. Much more to this effect he spoke, with an air impatient enough to make me know he would not be long in bondage, and though he suffered only the name of a slave, and had nothing of the toil and labour of one, yet that was sufficient to render him uneasy, and he had been too long idle, who used to be always in action and in arms. He had a spirit all rough and fierce, and that could not be tamed to lazy rest, and though all endeavours were used to exercise himself in such actions and sports as this world afforded, as running, wrestling, pitching the bar, hunting and fishing, chasing and killing tigers of a monstrous size, which this continent affords in abundance, and wonderful snakes, such as Alexander is reported to have encountered at the river of Amazons, and which Caesar took great delight to overcome, yet these were not actions great enough for his large soul, which was still panting after more renowned actions. End of part 6.